Welcome to season 25 of the Follow My Lead podcast, where each week I bring you stories and best practices of today's leaders to help you on your leadership journey. My name is John Eads. Here we go. Welcome back. I'm excited you're here another week to learn and grow and develop and get better. And that's exactly what we're going to do this week with my good friend, Mr. Roderick Yap. If you're not familiar with Roderick, he's played an enormous role in why I'm doing what I'm doing. He opened my eyes to the real power of leadership and looking at it through a more formal lens. And any opportunity I get to talk to Roderick, to pick his brain, I jump on it. And I think you're going to absolutely love this show because we're covering a topic that is so important right now, how to lead in uncertain times. And Roderick just delivers in all aspects of this show. So if you're in a position of leadership, this show is chocked full with value. One of the best parts of a discussion I've had in a long time is about how to handle pressure. And Roderick just does a phenomenal job of articulating how you can handle pressure and then how you can help others handle pressure as well. You're going to love this. This is an episode you're going to grow. So get ready. Get your Evernote out. Let's get ready to grow and develop. So without further ado, here is my good friend, Mr. Roderick Yap. Roderick Yap, welcome to the show.
How's it going? Good to speak to you.
I mean, because of the coronavirus, because it's changed all of us so much in so many different ways, I couldn't think of a better person to really dig into leading in uncertain times, and then certainly how leadership might have changed for this current time period. So let's start right there. Do you think it takes a different kind of leader in this environment versus normal times?
Yes, I think to some extent it does. I think the current environment is really testing leaders at all levels within their organizations. I think it's adding layers of pressure that probably lots of people haven't felt or experienced before. Added to that is the fact that people remember how you made them feel when times were difficult. So the decisions that you're making now will be remembered kind of in the future. And I'm reminded of that kind of that. There was a poster that was particularly popular in the UK around the Second World War, which was, a young child asking his father, Daddy, what did you do in the war? And I think we're kind of in that situation now. And I think that question is just as relevant. You know, what did you do during that crisis? How did you help people? How did you support people? Or how did you create something of value? You know, did you sit on your ass at home and do nothing but play computer games? Or did you learn a new language? Did you write a book? You know, what did you create that was a value for yourself and for the people around you? You know, what decisions did you take that moved the organization forward? You know, how did you seek an opportunity, or how did you seek to exploit the opportunities that sort of came about from this? I was having a conversation with a group of executive search, so, headhunters, with the CEO of that organization. And he said, a few of their rival firms were very, very quick to make people redundant and sort of move them out of the organization. And I was left thinking, well, if other firms are doing that, I'd be seeking to get in touch with, those top performers within those organizations that have been made redundant and say, hey, look, this is going to pass. What can I do to support you now? How can I set you up for success and support you through this current challenge so that when we come out of this, you're sort of set up for success? And I just think that the leaders that are able to manage the pressure and able to think about the long term and seek the opportunities in amongst all of the challenges that we're facing, they'll be the ones that set their organizations up for success in the long term.
You mentioned the word pressure twice. And I can't help but think of, the pressure of a golf tournament. It's one thing just to go practice on a range. It's another thing when the gun goes off, right? And how quickly people's game changes when the gun goes off in terms of a golf tournament. Now the pressure has been turned up, not just in our organizations to ensure that they exist in a few months or a couple years, people's jobs, as well as the pressure at home. So talk about pressure and how leaders can properly leverage pressure to help set themselves or their teams up for success.
So the first thing I think to note about pressure is that everyone feels it in different ways. If you've been exposed to it throughout your career, you will react to it differently because you probably develop some element of sort of coping mechanism. If you haven't, you might find it really, really difficult. So I think the first thing that leaders have to be aware of is, you know, how well do you know your people? How well do you know how much pressure they have been under? How well do you know to what extent this is having an impact on them? Because the answer to each of those questions, depending on how many people you lead, will be subtly different. And therefore, you need to adjust your approach in accordance with that individual, with the context that you're facing. The best thing or the best advice I've ever had about kind of leading pressure is managing under pressure or leading people under pressure is to focus on really what is the one thing that you need to get done next. You know, can you really draw it down to the sort of simplest next task that you need to take? And that's a real skill in a world where I think more and more people are distracted and there's lots of stuff going on, most of which they can't control. So when you talked about the sort of golf, the kind of golf analogy, I'm nowhere near the standard of golfer that you are, but I think that, you know, people start to get into trouble and the pressure starts to get to them when they start to think about the score and how many shots they've taken. And I would argue that the best golfers can laser-like focus on the ball and just hit it where they want it to go. Nothing else matters. And I think that focused application of your attention, particularly in a time like this, is really, really important. So focusing on what's the next thing you need to do. You know, have I checked in with my team and all of my people and all of my stakeholders in the last 24, 48 hours? Do I know how people are coping with this? And what can I do to ultimately set them up for success? If that's a relevant question for you,
it's so pertinent because it's like all we can really control is that shot in front of us. We can't control the outcome of the golf tournament, but just that shot. And when you start to think about it in terms of the pressure building on teams or organizations, everybody could work on a lot of different things, or they could work on nothing, Rod, because they're working from home. And so how, you know, we certainly lean heavily on the priorities that a leader might set, so people do know the next best action to take or in alignment with where we're focused. So as you start to think about priorities right now, how should leaders think about the short-term priorities without sacrificing the long term? Or should, during a time like this, we're so mission focused to make sure we even get to the long term that everything long term is kind of out the window? How do you think about short versus long term priorities in times like this? Or how should leaders?
So I think there's a real balance to be struck here. And I think each individual's context is sort of subtly different. I guess some people would say that this is kind of innate. I don't think it is. I think it's something that I've learned. In the back of my mind, running my business, I always had this kind of sense of, like, how much cash do I need to have, you know, tucked away to make sure that I consistently sort of pay the mortgage and that I could live just by paying out my fixed costs if no one bought a single thing off me tomorrow. Like, how long does that kind of last for? And I guess intuitively, sort of in the back of my mind, before I was looking to make any sort of significant investments in the growth and, you know, development of the of my organization, I wanted to get somewhere a minimum 6 months worth of cash in the bank. So if someone stopped buying from me tomorrow, I had like everything stopped. I could last for 6 months without any work. And I could continue to pay the bills and keep a roof over my head. So I think there's been an element of kind of preparation that I've done that. I've made sure that I've got that, got to a point where I've kind of got that sort of 6 months worth of supply. And then for me, because all of my work over the next kind of certainly at least 2 months has been cancelled or postponed, it's about speaking to people and going, well, look, is there an opportunity to, instead of delivering that face-to-face, deliver some of it online at a reduced cost? Or can I do something, you know, with the invoices so that instead of 30 days, they become 90 days? Is that going to be something that's sort of helpful? So how are you adapting to support your clients and the challenges that they're going through? What are the kind of things that you are able to offer them that sort of means that you can still kind of deliver some things? That was kind of the first thing that I went to. So a lot of my work at the moment has kind of moved on to webinars. And that's really what I'm trying to do in the kind of short term, is how can I just make sure that I just bring a bit of cash into the business? Because if I can generate a month's worth of costs, or a sort of, yeah, I guess if I can cover a month's worth of costs, that gives me another month to survive or another month of savings that I kind of don't have to dig into. Mm-hmm. But then added to that, once I've kind of set those wheels in motion and once I've kind of made time to sort of speak to all of my sort of key clients and key relationships, you kind of have to let that stuff, go off on its own. People know that you are there. They know you're good at what you do, hopefully. But then for me, the kind of the next step is to think about, right, what sort of value can I create so that I sort of springboard off the back of this? So I've got a guy that helps me out with my SEO optimization and my website design. This is a really good opportunity to spend some time working on the business rather than in the business. So what are the kind of things that I'm doing that are likely to lead to long-term success? Well, everyone's got that kind of longer to-do list that they never get to. That's what I've started to work through. So getting a book written, getting a series of articles written, getting on podcasts to kind of get my messages out there. All of those kind of things hopefully are going to set me up for success in the future. I may not be able to monetize them now, but that kind of doesn't matter. I think I have to accept what I can control and sort of focus on the things that are going to have impact in the long term.
Hopefully. So essentially it's the prioritization of the short-term things in terms of your tasks or daily next steps. These are the things that are going to help me or the team immediately because it's the most pressing thing you have, but we can't let go of the future vision that at some point we're going to come out the other side, and we want to make sure we're in a good position as that roller coaster goes down and starts to come back up, that we're well positioned for the future because we're going to be doing the things in the short term that get us there. And I think that the mentality that I want our listeners, or if you're listening today, to think about is, can you set priorities for your team for the short term that are going to make sure you get to the upswing? And then how can you have certain people are doing certain things that are going to set you up well for when that roller coaster starts to go back up? And I think you kind of verbalized that so well, Rod. We talked a little bit over the years about defining reality and making sure, I think Napoleon said a leader's job is to define reality and hope. And so I think they're tied mm-hmm. together, but it can be so difficult, Rod, for a leader to tell the truth, to be transparent, or to define reality at all in this current environment. Military wise, a team is backs against the wall and they're in a bad position. What responsibility do leaders play in defining reality? And then most importantly, if it is their responsibility, how can they do it more effectively?
So I think there are useful ways of thinking about these sorts of things. And there are things that are kind of less useful. I think with any situation, with any reality that you face, kind of reminding people that, look, it can always be worse. It can always be a worse situation. You know, most of us, given the current crisis, are being asked to stay at home at a time when we've never had more access to entertainment than we've ever had before. So, you know, you can get, I mean, can you imagine this, right? You can, if you're stuck at home, you've got access to Netflix, the internet, YouTube. You know, how you use that time can be, you know, focused on self-development or purely on kind of entertainment. But the fact of the matter is that's kind of a choice that you have. If this had happened 30 years ago, we'd have been stuck at home rewatching our old video collection and maybe four or five channels on television. You know, how much more painful that would have been. If we were, you know, facing something similar to this kind of crisis, and the nearest thing I can think of is probably the Second World War. If we were facing that, most of us fighting age males would be packed off into, you know, a training camp to join the army and be conscripted to sent off to France. So I think it kind of reminding people that, A, it can always be worse. And the faster that you can get them thinking about where do the opportunities lie? Where are there opportunities to do something different? Where can we use some of our strengths to solve some problems and challenges that are being faced now? I look at sort of Formula One teams and Dyson in the UK, who have switched their focus from racing or the manufacture of what they've been manufacturing to date, their current products, to thinking about how do we rapidly produce large amounts of, I don't know, face masks or ventilators. What are things that people need right now? How can we switch a focus onto that? So I think wherever possible, you know, the environment might change, but that just opens up another opportunity. And I think where leaders can switch people on to start thinking about opportunities and how they can exploit them, I think is kind of absolutely key. In the UK, we're furloughing loads and loads of people. They're being sort of effectively put onto the kind of almost government payroll. You can't have them working for your organization if the government are effectively covering 80% of their salary, but you are allowed to train them. So I'd be encouraging those people to sort of look at what sort of training courses have they always wanted to do. How can we as an organization support that? They've now got the time and the capacity. How can we create a situation whereby they come back into this organization and this industry in a much stronger position? Those are the sort of things that I would encourage people to start thinking about.
So I want you to take me back to any of your, you know, military days when it looked a little bleak. You know, the what was in front of you not only looked bleak, but it certainly looked challenging. Did you want your commander to tell you all of the facts of the situation? Did you prefer it to be more vague? I mean, what responsibility does a leader have to tell the truth if they know it?
My view with this is always give people as much information as you can. I think if you're thinking about it for the sort of long term, they will respect your openness and your transparency. If you say, look, right now, this is what I know. And I can't sugarcoat it. I can't dress it up. This is the kind of situation you're in. And then quickly switching them to sort of think about, like, you know, it's not so much the situation that's the problem. It's what we do now that mm-hmm. dictates whether or not we're going to live or die, or how we come out of this, and how we lead the men through this. I would always advocate for more transparency and more openness, though.
It's interesting, though, because it goes against kind of the things most leaders it's hard to admit that, because it almost might be a knock on them. They might not have seen something coming. So we know why leaders don't do it, right? Because to protect their positional authority, or to protect their position, or just for the matter to not make them look weak. But in reality, it really makes them look strong, doesn't it? I was thinking of the Zoom CEO just this week. It comes out that Zoom had some security flaws. And with this 40, 50% jump in usage, it was exposed. And I couldn't help but respect the fact that their CEO came out and said, I made some mistakes. I mean, he just was brutally honest. He was truthful about it. And yeah. For, you know, and I know that could be scary for a CEO or a team leader to say, I made some mistakes and here's the current situation. Here's how we're going to go address it. I admire the man's courage, don't you?
Yeah, massively. And I think too often we sort of hold up leaders that don't turn around and say, you know, I got this wrong. I have massive admiration for people that have the courage to do that. And I mean, let's be honest, like even Zoom as an organization, they can't have predicted this. Mm-hmm. And so whilst they may have had people, you know, kind of working on the sort of security aspect, I'm sure it probably wasn't their biggest priority. Maybe it should have been, but you know, that's kind of easy to say, but we don't know what's going on within that organization. The reality is they've seen demand for their services go through the roof. I think, you know, someone said to me the other day that Zoom is now worth approximately 50% of some of the major, I think four or five of the major airlines in the US. Hmm. You know, that's just phenomenal. So yes, they've been spectacularly fortunate that they've seen demand go through the roof, but I think this sort of aspect of catastrophic success has left them perhaps slightly exposed. But I think that, you know, as the CEO has been quick to kind of identify, yeah, you know, we've made some mistakes. That's fair to say. But you know, who wouldn't have, given the amount of attention that they've received as their services have kind of gone through the roof? I'm sure they weren't forecasting that demand in their 2020 plans. I'm sure they weren't ready for it. But, you know, they're a software organization. They'll be able to adapt quickly. For me, yeah, the security thing is relevant. But I just think, you know, yeah, that's an area where maybe they're a bit weak on. But I think the quality of the software, the ease of use of it, I just think is so good.
Yeah, it's kind of over. They'll overcome, but it would have been really difficult for them to overcome without him taking that step.
Yeah,
you know, 100%. If it was a bunch of excuses or, you know, instead he dealt with the facts, man, and yeah. He took responsibility for them. And now imagine working on that team, Rod, and being like, I might even have been running the security division within the business. And instead of it falling all on my shoulders and me being let go, my boss takes the responsibility and says, that's on me and we're going to go fix it. And like, now imagine working for him and going to fix the security or tighten it up in a quick manner. You're going to work five times as hard versus him coming down and saying, oh, it was Rod's fault and we're going to work on it. I mean, no one's going to want to work hard for them. And so I want to highlight that today, because when you're dealing with defining reality for people and taking responsibility, it's maybe more essential now than ever before. And it's not a sign of weakness. It's a sign of strength. And that's what I want our listeners to take away from today. Another area that I really want to jump in with you, because I think it's so pertinent today, which is this idea of kind of command and control leadership and how it's kind of been replaced in the modern time. And it has me really thinking about some of your work around this idea of the spectrum of control from leaders. Can you dig into this work a little bit and what your thinking is as you relates to spectrums of leadership?
Yeah, so my thinking on the subject has kind of evolved over the past 5 years, as I think you would expect it to. And I've been someone that's always been keen to try and, I guess, break models as much as possible, because I think you need to be aware of a model's limitations as well as its strengths. So originally I focused my sort of understanding of leadership on really a kind of set of principles. But the more I've started to think about it, the more I've started to think about kind of more a set of spectrums. most people would say to you that empowering people is a really important part of leadership. And I would agree. We used to empower relatively young Marines to make some of the most important decisions that a person can take, specifically the decision to take someone's life. It doesn't get much bigger than that. However, does that mean that empowerment is the right way of leading in every single scenario? I'm not so sure. If you and me were to walk out of the studio, walk across the road and see someone get hit by a car, the last thing you would probably want me to do is turn to you and say, John, do you think it's the right thing to do to call the ambulance, or should we call the police first? Now, technically, I'm empowering you, but I've just exposed what I think is a really inappropriate way of behaving. In that situation, where time is of the essence and people's lives are at risk and it's high stress, you would probably want to be much more directive. So you probably want someone to turn around and say, you call the ambulance, you go down there and stop these cars, you talk to that person because they're hurt, but they're conscious. And you can see how you're adjusting your approach to more of a centralized command and control approach. Now, I would argue that empowered leadership most of the time in organizations is kind of what you want to be aiming for. Certainly if you're leading an experienced team of people that know what they're doing. But if you're leading a really junior group of, say, graduates, for example, who have just left college and this is kind of their first job, you might need to be much more directive. You might literally need to tell them what to wear to the office and how to behave and what's acceptable and what's unacceptable. Again, that's much, much more directive. So I think what good leaders are able to do is understand the context that they're facing, understand the natural way that they have of behaving. So do they lean more towards empowering people, or are they a bit more kind of command and control orientated, and then choose the best way to behave given the sort of circumstances. So often you'll find people who are leading experienced teams who have a sort of command and control natural style. They're good in that sort of crisis situation, often might sort of dig into the detail and be accused of perhaps micromanaging some quite senior people. But for a junior team, that might be entirely appropriate. But equally, people that have only ever led really, really senior people and have sort of left them to kind of get on with it might struggle to provide the guidance and direction to a sort of, I guess, a more junior team. So I think it's leadership more now is about so thinking about the context that you're facing, thinking about how do I naturally behave in these situations, and then how do I want to behave in order to get the best outcome. And we've just talked about one there. There are kind of other ones that I can go into in a bit more detail. But I think that understanding the context and choosing the way to behave is now how I think about leadership.
It's really fascinating stuff. And, you know, you could leverage one approach, one moment or time, and you could leverage a different approach the next moment in time. And I think what's ironic about both approaches is that both would be handled better by the direct report of the person that you're directing or empowering if the relationship is stronger. And 100%. And I think that that's just so true in today's environment, which is when your people know that you care, you know, that you have a strong relationship with them and there's high levels of trust, regardless of which method you choose in that moment, it's just going to go better. They're going to be more receptive to it and they're going to react better to it. And I think it's interesting stuff. You were the first person that turned me on to this idea of how important standards are for a leader to both clarify and then certainly to enforce. And I'll never forget, you know, when you mentioned that word to me, most people think of it as expectations or of some kind, but you really put it you defined it as the best way of doing something at a given point of time, It's defined as a standard is defined as what good looks like in the dictionary. We've come to realize that great leaders don't define what good looks like. Great leaders define what great looks like.
Yeah.
You mentioned this man named Dick Fosbury. I think that's how you pronounce his last name. Tell our audience about Dick and how this relates to standards in today's environment.
So Dick Fosbury, was the inventor of the Fosbury flop. And I believe early 1960s, he won the Olympic gold medal by completely changing the way that he approached the high jump. And it's a really interesting story about innovation and standards. So initially, when people were performing the high jump, I think they used to do something called the Western roll. And then at a point in time, another technique came along, which I think was called the straddle. Now, I'm sure there are videos for these high jump techniques, but you'll see that they look kind of a bit alien now. And then in the, I think, late 50s, the matting that was used for the high jump changed. And it was made much, much thicker, much, much deeper. And so Dick Fosbury looked at this and said, and sort of was like, well, hang on a sec. The environment has changed. Is there a way in which I can now clear the bar and sort of and do it differently, maybe do it better? Mm-hmm. And I think this really nicely shows the relationship between standards and continuous improvement, because the standard is just the one best way of doing something at a given moment in time, as you correctly identify. But the way in which you innovate is you look at the circumstances, and you have to keep that kind of continuous improvement Kaizen mindset in the back of your mind to consistently keep asking, is this still the one best way? Has anything changed that might indicate that there could be another way of doing this? Because only when you start to look for those exponential changes in the way you do something do you sort of open up the opportunities to do something sort of completely different. And I think the coronavirus now is an example of where the situation has changed massively. It's a bit like the late 50s when they changed the matting. And whoever is able to take advantage of that situation is going to see their organization set up for success in the future. I think Zoom will be one of them. I don't think that this remote working is going to go away. I think it will challenge the way that some people create organizations. And I would like to think that more of them would sort of go down the Matt Mullenweg route of creating something a bit more like automatic, because I think that this distributed working has huge potential for people to get a much better sense of autonomy and work-life balance.
And I appreciate the example, because in today's world, I mean, standards are essential for leaders to define. There's no doubt about that. But we have to be open to doing some things differently at a given point in time. And oftentimes we need our teams or others to either, you know, think of the game of football, right? I mean, it's changed so much. That's American football, Rod. But it's changed so much because people have found different ways to do things based on the current rules or the current standards that exist in the game. And I want, if you're leading a team today, you know, what are the standards that exist today? And then how can we help leverage our team's collective intelligence to help look for new and better ways to do things at this given point of time? And there's nothing wrong with testing and trying and modifying and working hard to find better ways to do something. And there might not be a better time than right now. Rod, thank you so much for making time to come on the show. Where can people find out more about your work and about you?
So I'm on LinkedIn, Roderick Yap. It's one of the good things about having a pretty unique name is that people can find me. And my website where I write is leadershipforces.com. You can see some of my ideas there, and hopefully, you know, that you'll be able to get some value out of them, and some of the stuff might be useful to you.
Well, we will make sure to point people in the right places. As I've told you many times before, there might not be a man that's made a bigger impact on my thinking than you. And so from me to you during this difficult time, thank you. And I'm so glad that you get to continue to shed some light and to help our audience as well. Thank you, Rod.
Not at all. Very happy to help. Thanks, John.